I'm a mythical Pandora,
sent here to judge the universe.
Do you have any idea what the weapon is?
It could very well be a planet killer.
I would really like to go on this mission, Admiral.
Imagine having the power to annihilate entire worlds, and even the stars themselves.
Humanity is worth saving. What have you done?
Pandora. New episodes premiere October 4th. Free next day, only on the CW app.
Catch up with the entire season of Pandora anytime on the CW app or download it on iTunes. You can also watch Pandora in Canada on the Space Channel.
Welcome back to Unboxing Pandora, the podcast where we take a behind-the-scenes look into the hit CW show, Pandora. I am so excited for today's show. We have director Brett Simmons on for an amazing conversation about his work on Pandora. Brett got a start as a writer and director for horror movies like 2013's Husk and 2018's You Might Be the Killer, before joining the Pandora team to direct three episodes of Season 1 and the first two episodes of Season 2. I had a fantastic time talking with Brett. Beyond Pandora talk, this episode has some great insights into working your way up through the Hollywood system as a writer and director. We get into all this and more on today's episode. My name is Peter Holmstrom. I'm the writer's assistant on Pandora, and I hope you enjoy this podcast. Brett Simmons, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's going to be so much fun. I have so many questions for you, but first and foremost, you just got back from Bulgaria where you were filming Season 2. So tell us how that went.
It was, well, you know, coming back was a thing, but no, being out there was awesome. It was really cool. It was really surreal, you know, because we're, it's like, I mean, there's no surprise, like we're all like in around the world, like in the middle of this pandemic. And so traveling was interesting this time around because the only way we got into Bulgaria was as essential workers. Mm-hmm. So that proved to be interesting because, you know, Mark, our showrunner, was the first person to cross the border after all of this essential worker stuff happened. And I was the second. And I think he's a much more confident. And I think he's a much more confident person traveling than I am. And so like I got to customs and that was, we had a ton of paperwork. Like, this is why we're allowed to enter and this is what we're doing, you know, all pertaining to the show. But I'm in general, I'm a bit of a nervous Nelly with that stuff. So I just kind of got to customs like, hey, please let me come in. But otherwise, no, it was really good. It was good to be back. You know, the analogy that we were using a lot was, you know, it's like coming back to college for sophomore year versus freshman year.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Season 1 was very much freshman year. Like, okay, where are we at? Who are my friends? Where are my classes? You know, it's like there's a lot of like that type of vibe. Whereas this season, it was just really great because everybody's back. You know, it's all like, it's all the same crew, you know, of course, already know the cast. And so it was a lot more like an exciting reunion, you know? So it was just really, really good to be back. And another thing that was cool too, was it was, you know, Pandora was one of the, if not the, don't quote me on this. We either were the, or were at least one of the, first productions to be back up off the ground and running in Bulgaria.
Very true.
And so it was cool because the crew, not only were we all excited just to see each other again, but everyone's just so excited to be back, back working, you know? Absolutely. And so that was something really unexpected this season was, I think we all were already excited and already grateful, but there was a really tangible and palpable sense of gratitude on set that I've never really experienced before. Just in the midst of all the insanity, just, man, not only are we glad to be back, but we are so glad to be back right now.
Yeah.
So it was really, really cool. I mean, the enthusiasm and the positivity and the gratitude and brotherhood on set, and sisterhood on set was just like off the charts. It was really cool.
That's fantastic. Now, I'm so curious because you directed three episodes for Season 1 that spans, you were there at the beginning, then you came back a little later on. And I'm curious, like, what were some of the lessons that you learned from Season 1 that you were able to apply when you came back here to do Season 2?
Dude, great question.
Thank you.
You know, it was funny. You're welcome. You did your homework. I'm like, wow, you're right. I was there for now. How did I do this? You're right. No, well, it was, I wasn't, I went and I did episodes 4 and 5 of last season. Mm-hmm. And that was my first time directing television, period.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot to learn for me, but then also just like learning the ins and outs of our show, you know, like what our sets are like, you know, what our cast is like, what our team is like, and learning all those things. Mm-hmm. And when I was done with 4 and 5, my block that I did, we were all really enthusiastic, and the sense was that like it went really well, and I definitely got along really well with the cast and the team. And so when I came back to do episode 10, that was like one of the highlights of my career, because it was the first time I've ever returned to a crew that I've worked with. I've never actually gotten to work with the same, you know, top to bottom crew.
Time.
I've shared collaborators, you know, like I've worked with like a lot of the same people just throughout project, but never like the whole cast and crew. So it was really nuts, because I like came back for episode 10 and I just knew everybody and they all knew me and we already had like a shorthand. So that felt like vacation, like in comparison to the first block. It was just like, yeah, I know how to do this and I only got to do one episode and we all know each other and we're all going to have a good time. And that was a blast. But it also, the reason I say it was because a lot of the lessons I learned, on my first two episodes, I was able to apply then. And then I applied a lot of the same lessons this time coming back. And a lot of it was just pacing. You know, it's like in television, you move a lot faster than when you're making a movie. And when you're making a movie, you know, you get to really, you get to really design a lot of very specific things to do a lot of your own storytelling. Whereas with TV, while you get to have your own flourishes, really your job is to deliver something that, you know, the network and the team can ultimately create a good TV episode with. You know, it's not necessarily, it's not just yours, you know, it's like you're serving a greater ship, you know?
Right.
And so the rule of thumb that I kind of set, that I learned season one, that I applied when I did episode 10 and even more so this time, was, man, if I can get away with just one shot every scene that feels like a me shot or feels like kind of a selfish, stylized, super cool moment, I feel like I won. That's kind of like been my philosophy a lot, is just, you know, let's get all the coverage we need, let's make sure that we're sending as much as we can to the edit room to make this work as well as possible, but here's where I'm also going to have my creative flourish to kind of make it feel like something extra cool, you know.
Well, then let's back up a little bit to give the listeners an idea of what that might mean. You know, when I first was pitching Mark on this idea of just doing this podcast, I was, part of my pitch was that I'm just so fascinated by where the creativity from Pandora comes from, because it feels like we, and I love this about the show, is that we all come from different backgrounds. We come from different parts of the world. And, you know, Hollywood can sometimes be very, you know, a certain show has a very similar type of people in it, but our show, it's very eclectic. Everyone comes from everywhere. And I love that. So let's back up a little bit. Like where does Brett Simmons come from? How did you first get into filmmaking?
Wow. Who is Brett Simmons? Why is Brett
on a
Simmons?
Metaphysical level? why are you here?
Wow. Oh my gosh. Whoa. You know, Peter, I think I got to go. No. That's so funny. I grew up in San Diego and, came from a family of artists. And so there's just a lot of support for pursuing arts from just like birth onward, which was great. And, to the point that when I was in high school, I got to go to a school of the arts, and that was really where I kind of, film was always my trajectory. It was always where I was aiming, but, high school, going to a school of the arts is when I first kind of started to engage in actual training. You know, it's like, I mean, everything's training. And I was making movies like crazy when I was a kid, but my VHS camcorder and, you know, doing what I thought movie making was and mimicking who I thought great filmmakers were.
Right.
And just watching movies like crazy. But then in high school, I was able to actually start kind of training more specifically in that direction. which is really cool. My high school film was still kind of a new thing. Like I was in high school in the, I'm going to date myself, but I mean, oh, well, I don't care. But it was, I was in high school at the end of the 90s. So I graduated in 2000. So end of the 90s, you know, like film was a popular discussion, but not all the schools in the world were necessarily teaching it yet, you know? So the film school that I, or the school of the arts I went to had a major emphasis on theater. And that was the only thing they really knew to do with me. So I was like, he's our film student, but I was just taking theater classes. And yeah, he wants to learn how to be a director, but I was just learning how to direct theater. But it actually, it's since been one of the greatest things I think that ever happened to me as far as my training, because I didn't realize how much proper film school doesn't teach directing actors. It teaches directing cameras.
Very true.
And so, so when I transitioned into film school, I went to Chapman University.
Nice.
And that's where I started like all the technical training, but thank God it worked out the way it did, because I kind of went in with a base of how to work with actors and a comfort level with actors, you know, and now I was kind of filling in the technical gaps. So that honestly, it was really, I was very fortunate in that way. And that's something that I feel like is one of my strengths, is just being able to communicate with actors. And I love actors. I love actors. I love the camera too, but you know, I have two brains on set. Basically, the actors get half and the camera gets half.
Well, and I think it's so interesting that you say that, because when I was watching some of your early films, it really occurred to me that they, you know, partly this is a production issue, right? You're doing, you got your start working on lower budget horror movies, right? Which are very interesting. And yet what I felt when I was watching them is that these are very focused on actors' moments. They're very focused on character moments in a way that you don't necessarily expect from this genre, which can oftentimes just be like a scare fest type thing, right? And I was very frustrated at that. I was like, this is very good. This is awesome.
Oh, thanks, man. Now I mean, I knew you did your homework, but now I'm like scared. I'm like, oh no, what did he watch?
Well, I'll tell you, like last night I watched You Might Be the Killer.
Nice.
With Allison Hannigan. And it was just fantastic. I thought it was very clever, and also co-written by Tom Piafatale, who was a producer and co-writer on Pandora. So to jump, well, before we get to that, because I feel like that's jumping ahead a little bit, but like you got out of Chapman, and I went to film school myself. I went to the American Film Institute, and I knew a lot of people who did go to Chapman. And it's a very good school. I mean, it has a huge,
I love Chapman.
I don't know if you were you there after they did their big renovation? Like they built this whole new facility for their film?
No, you know, it's a real, real sore subject for me, because my freshman year, I'm teasing. It's not actually, it's just kind of funny, because my freshman year when I started, they're like, hey guys, guess what? We have a giant grant, and they like had the model and the plan and everything for like the new studio, like all the stuff. Cause Chapman at the time was gaining a lot of acclaim, but was kind of meeting out of a glorified renovated, cafeteria. Like our film school used to be the offices for all the coaches for the sports.
Oh, wow.
And if you know Chapman, you probably do not know Chapman sports, because their sports are not what they're known for. Yeah, so it's like, wow, if we had the offices of those coaches,
right.
No offense if you coaches are listening, but, but yeah, we did not have great facilities, but what we didn't have in facilities, they made up for and like, just like crazy, with great professors, great, you know, projects and work ethic and drive. I mean, they put a camera in your hand day one, and we're just driving you to just make content. It was really, the atmosphere was amazing, but yeah, our facilities weren't great. So our freshman year, they were like, hey, guess what? You guys are gonna be breaking in the new studio your junior year. And I was like, yeah. And then sophomore year, they're like, okay, there's a little delay, but guess what? You're going to be doing your senior theses in the new studio. And we're like, yeah. And then junior year, they're like, we're sorry. We don't know when it's going to happen. And they broke ground on it the year after I graduated.
Wow.
But one thing that's cool, just the furthest thing of praises of Chapman, is that they, because they very much have a mom pop spirit behind like their film school, they do have an open door to alumni. So what's really funny is they finished the studio, and I still had friends at the school, and I had great relationships with the staff. And my first feature is a feature no one's no one's seen, and I don't know how anyone ever would see, but I did like a micro budget romantic comedy. And the reason I did it was because I knew I was going to be making Husk. I can get into that story in a second, but I knew I was going to be making like my first horror movie, Husk, which had a more significant budget. Mm-hmm. But we were delayed. It's a scarecrow movie and it takes place in a cornfield, and cornfields only exist during a certain season of the year. So I'm just waiting. And so I was able to produce and direct this micro budget feature in the meantime that I just felt, one, I wanted to do it, and two, I felt like it would be better to get the greases, like, you know, greased before I was on production for the horror movie. So I was doing this cool romantic comedy that I'm really proud of. It's just small. And the only reason I was able to finish it was because I was able to do all of my posts through Chapman's new studio. So I literally, like, we went in there. I did a lot of my edit there. We did our telescene there, our color correction. We did our sound mix there in their big stage. We did so much there that even though I didn't have it for school, I still had it, you know, and technically still have it. Like, the door is wide open and the facilities are incredible. Yeah. They're awesome. So yeah, I missed out on it when I was in school, but I've still been reaping the benefits of that awesome place for sure. nothing but good things to say about Chapman.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, I have to say, like, the big reason why I went with AFI as opposed to Chapman, like, I got into both schools, and big reason why I went to AFI was just the proximity to internship possibilities. Cause like, I had a friend of mine who I was interning with at a place called Skybound Entertainment, and she went to Chapman and she had to commute like 2.5 hours sometimes to get up there. And I was like, fuck, I don't want to do that at all.
Yeah, I went through that myself. I know. I had to intern at New Line Cinema, and there was a whole semester of doing that commute that was, I learned a lot of tricks, but it was brutal.
Isn't that in Burbank? I mean,
they're in Burbank now. At the time, they were still in their previous offices, which were in more Beverly Hills.
Okay. Still brutal. Brutal.
Yeah, still brutal. In fact, I feel like it might actually be easier to commute to Burbank than Beverly Hills from Orange County, but yeah, I know your pain. You were wiser than me.
Well, I mean, at the same time, it's very interesting and lovely to hear how supportive they are of their students and of their filmmakers there.
It was cool. And really what launched my career was my senior thesis was Chapman's first Sundance film. Like, it went Sundance, which was insane. And like, I completely unexpected but it happened, and it was a short of basically my movie Husk. The feature was a feature based off of a short film that I made, and that short went to Sundance. And so I was graduated at the time. I just graduated because it got accepted in the fall after I graduated. And Chapman was unbelievably supportive and just enthusiastic, you know, and having an alumni there. And Chapman always has a presence there, but they really, they gave me like a PR person, and they threw a Chapman party, and it was this whole crazy, crazy thing that just further solidified my forever heart for Chapman, you know. But yeah, that's that kind of, just further answering your question, was kind of when all the next steps fell into place, was being at Sundance with my short film, and then ultimately pitching and selling the feature adaptation of it, which I later directed.
That's awesome. That's so cool. And so I'm curious then about, like, you turn this short film into a feature, which is basically the dream of every film student, right? They're always hoping their short films will get turned into feature films.
Right.
You know, you're given a certain budget, you know, walk us through that experience of, like, you're directing your first feature film. It's a budget of what it is, you know, like, talk to us about that.
Oh, I'll tell you all that. So the budget was $1.5 million.
Okay.
And which of course, like, I was like, what? This is crazy. And we shot in Iowa, and they make a little bit, just a little bit, but it was really surreal. And, you know, I probably learned the most I've ever learned making that movie. It was very much like a baptism by fire. I thought I knew how to make movies until I had to be at the helm of $1 million budget and a big crew and a delivery date and returns like expectations on returns of investment, all that, like that. That was when the education you don't get in film school really started. And I had a line producer on that movie who really was probably just like my guardian angel at that point, because her name was Carrie O'Reilly, and she's unbelievable, still line producing. And she really looked after me and would just like teach me all just like the tricks and stuff along the way. Cause I was only, I was in my 20s when I directed it. And so it was interesting. Sorry. Well, I mean, I feel like, you know, there's only the Coen brothers, what, were 21 when they started making movies, and I don't know how they did it. And obviously it's because they're geniuses. Cause I was 27 and I had no business being on that set. I should have been thrown off many times, but it was interesting because there were just so many in and outs that no one had ever taught me, just like political things and just tricks for making it through your day. You know, I had never dealt with a page count day. I had produced all my own movies in college, and I don't know how I did it. I just always made my stuff without any problems. And so the whole idea of needing to shoot a certain amount of content a day, I had never encountered that before. I'd never dealt with a producer sitting with me at Video Village, like scrutinizing everything I was doing. And so I don't want to say that the experience was entirely pleasant, but it was entirely educational. You know, like I came out of that experience a very different filmmaker for the better. And, you know, at the end of the day, like, because I wrote it, you know, I had the movie in my blood because I had already made the short film, and the short film became ultimately my warm-up lap for the feature. And so when we got into the cornfields, even though I was, you know, kind of the young guy on set, and, you know, and that was what was weird, was the dynamic of the everybody above the line as far as like the producing team was very divided over Brent went to Sundance, like he made an awesome short, like, guys, we got to support him, it's going to be amazing. And then the other half was, who is this clown? He's just a baby. He doesn't know what he's doing.
Right.
And that was really kind of weird to be stuck in the middle of, because you're just kind of like, I know who my friends are, I know who my enemies are. And for some reason, my enemies are around more.
Right.
But what was cool was, because I had made the short film, I kind of became the authority on set on how to shoot in a cornfield, you know? So when everyone's going, he doesn't know what he's doing, then it's like, but how should we set this up? I'm like, okay, guys, this is what we need to do. And da, 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 da. Shooting in corn. I mean, I know we're not trying to talk about this movie, so I'll keep it really short, but
we're here for corn. We're here for corn.
Okay. Because I want to make sure we talk about Pandora, obviously, but corn, when you're shooting in corn, it's a lot like shooting in water. And I learned that making the short film, in the sense that like, there's no sense of geography once you're in, in cornfield, like corn's corn. And so one of the things I learned making the short that I did in the feature that really started to win a lot of favor with the production team was, I was like, we just need stations within this cornfield. Like, we need a station where we have dolly track. Corn is an alley of corn is leveled to put a dolly track. And whenever we want to do dolly stuff and running stuff, this is our station to do that stuff. And then we do this clearing here, and this is where we want to do steady cams following people. And we need the corn to be a little bit thinner, but we still want to feel like we're walking through it. And so we just had all these stations for different things within the cornfield, just to get certain types of shots. And let's set up the jib arm over here so that it's always ready for when we want to do this. And da 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 da. And you never know, like, you would never know that we're just bouncing all over this tiny patch of cornfield to pull off all these pieces within a massive cornfield. Like, whenever you see the wides of the cornfield, we never shot in that much corn. So it's all just an illusion. So every time I think they thought about firing me, they realized that they couldn't because of that alone was it. So it was cool. I mean, that was really cool. And obviously it springboarded not just my ability to keep working and the education I needed on how to survive as a, you know, in the business of show business. But the movie also did really well. And halfway through the shoot, the dailies came back, and all of a sudden all the producers that hated me liked me. I'm not bragging. That's not like, because I'm awesome. It was, they just saw that I actually had a vision, and I actually like had a competency with where to place the camera and block actors. And so the dailies came back, and everybody that hated me all of a sudden was like, okay, we'll leave them alone. And then the rest of the process was great. Post-production was great. And, you know, it was onward from there.
That's fantastic. So I'm curious then, what were your next two movies? Were they, did you pitch for them yourself, or were they, did they come to you and say, hey, we would love for you to do this project?
Great question. So the next two movies I did Monkey's Paw and Animal for NBC Universal and Chiller. And that they actually came to me. I pitched like crazy for different movies. I was also like deep in the weeds on a few more original screenplays that I was trying to pitch and get going. And I had a lot of almosts. I think a lot of directors deal with that, which is like, it's just, honestly, the life of a director, I think, is very parallel to an actor in the sense of like, you're not auditioning for movies, you're auditioning to direct movies. And so you're emotionally just in this constant tug of war of like, oh, this is how I do this. And and I, being so close to certain movies, I did meet a lot of heroes, which was really cool. But none of them came to fruition. But then Monkey's Paw was on Chiller, and that was really cool because NBC Universal, they had reached out to me because Husk, my movie Husk, part of its distribution deal was that it was going to air on Sci-Fi, which begins my connection to one of my favorite people, Tom Vitale. And he was, you know, he was sitting at the top of Sci-Fi at the time and their film stuff. And when they acquired Husk, Husk aired really well on television because Husk, and this was not intentional, this was completely accidental. It was another case of me tripping into some success. Definitely not landing myself into success. Husk is so active and it has so many like twists and pieces and suspense that when it aired on Sci-Fi, they were noticing how the commercial breaks, everyone, they had a lot, they were staying through commercial breaks for Husk more than most of their stuff at the time. The other movies they were airing, Husk just like really moved and kept viewers' interest, and they just felt it was because each act had something to keep them coming back at the commercial form, which is entirely accidental, but it put me on their radar. And so they were really interested in having me involved with just one of their originals. And Chiller at the time was, you know, a sister to Sci-Fi, at least as far as I understand. To be honest, Tom Vitale can explain all of this like so much better than me. This is like my like what like this amateur like interpretation of it all. But Chiller was related to Sci-Fi, but their whole goal was they wanted to do Sci-Fi very much had a brand. And they really wanted to have another avenue by which to distribute and showcase stuff that could be branded differently, more horror focused, not quite as cheesy, or over the top, you know, just a little more grounded type stuff. And, which I thought was really cool. And I was on board. I was like, heck yeah. I mean, I like sci-fi stuff too, but that was seemed really exciting. And so they had a movie that Macon Blair, had written. Macon did Blue Ruin and he's amazing. And he had written it and a director had fallen out. So they needed a new director and they were trying to find something for me because of Husk. So they called me and it was, it came across, I mean, it came about really easily. Like it was just one of those things where I was fighting for all these other projects and nothing was happening. And then all of a sudden I got a call and I was all of a sudden signed to direct a movie that I never even knew was happening, you know? So that was really nice. And it was in New Orleans and that was cool. And then that movie kind of begot the next movie, which was Animal, which they were distributing, but was a different production company. It was Flower Films, which is Drew Barrymore's company. But it was just another one of those things where they were really happy with me. And so when something else came about that they needed someone for, my name got thrown up. So it was like, I was finishing one movie that I never expected and got thrown right into another movie that I wasn't even anticipating. I did have to go pitch for that one, but it just came about much easier than anything else I'd been trying to get going. And I had a blast on that one too. It was a monster movie. So it was like, oh my gosh, it was just ridiculous how much fun I had making Animal.
I'm curious though, because you know, when you say pitch for me as a screenwriter, you know, studied screenwriting at American Film Institute, like I have an idea of what pitching is. Right. And yet I'm curious from your perspective as a director, you know, how does one actually pitch for a project like this? And what's your personal philosophy on it? Because I know everyone's different about what they like to do, what they don't like to do.
So the thing for me is I'm as interested in hearing other directors answer this question as you are, because it's like the thing that's funniest about directing is I don't get to sit in on other directors' pitch meetings,
right.
And I don't get to sit on set with other directors. You know, directors are generally competing for all the same jobs, you know? Sure. And so, which again, like looking ahead at Pandora, that's part of what's been incredible about Pandora, is it's the most time I've gotten to spend on set with other people directing. Mm. You know, I'm going back really quick. Because of my background of working with actors in high school, when I got to college, I learned that I'm a horrible crew member. and the easiest way for me to get on set was to act in movies more than crew movies.
Oh, okay.
And I don't consider myself to be an actor, but I'm competent enough that I can trick a lot of people that I know what I'm doing. And so I actually did get to interface with a lot of directors in my film school just by nature of acting in their movies, which helped me learn. But, you know, we were all learning. It's not really fair to... You don't really want to get your education from someone who's also still getting their education. And right. I kind of wish you could just watch someone that has a bunch of experience. But coming back to the question, like, you know, directors don't get to really watch other directors. You kind of just do what you do. And I've asked directors how they pitch, and everyone tells me a different story. Mm-hmm. Some people go in with like giant, like the cardstock poster boards.
Sure. Yeah.
With like images and stuff like that. Some directors come in with sizzle reels. Some guys come in with PowerPoints. Some guys come in with all of the above. And some guys go in with nothing. Like they just go in with just a very clean, rehearsed, this is what I would do. Because really what the pitch is, I guess I could answer, is you're trying to sell them on what your vision for the movie is. Mm-hmm. And then they either like it or they don't, you know. And it's kind of like with acting, you know, it's like, it's really why I parallel it a lot. And I don't know how much, you know, again, I'm a little out of touch with, you know, how much everybody knows about the acting world or not. I just happen to know a lot, but it's, you know, you're going into the audition for an acting role. You're going in with your interpretation of a character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they may give you notes in the room for your performance, but you're kind of just going in, all right, I read these signs. This is my version of the character. And you're either going to like this version or not. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from the being on the casting side of the table, that's what I'm looking for, is just someone's flavor. And I know what flavor I'm kind of looking for. And I'm most keeping my eye out for the person that captures it. It's the reason why there's so many talented actors that don't get the roles, you know?
Yeah.
It's like it has nothing to do with talent. It has to do with, you weren't the vibe I was looking for, or you didn't come with the flavor I was looking for. And then you find it in somebody, and that's why they get the role. And it's literally the same thing with directing. You're kind of going, this is my interpretation of the movie. It's instead of the role. And this is what I would imbue it with. It's like, instead of flavor of your character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, and, you know, it always goes back to me with the deleted scenes for Back to the Future, right? Where they first had Stoltz on there as Marty McFly. And you know, he's a fine actor. I really like him in a lot of roles, but it just wasn't working. You know, it just wasn't quite right. And so then they get rid of him. They bring in Michael J. Fox. It's the same script. It's the same director, but it's an entirely different character, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not even that it's wrong. It's just it's just not what Zemeckis was looking for, you know. And that's exactly right. And like, I do try and like remind, I have a lot of friends that are actors, and most of them know, but it still stinks, you know. No one wants to be invested enough in a role to go for it and lose it. And it's the same with directing. It's
sure.
It's so hard to get emotionally invested enough in a project to go pitch it and not get it, you know. I was talking to a directing friend of mine recently who they lost out on a movie, and it stinks. Even if it's a movie like, oh, the budget wasn't great, the premise wasn't my favorite, I'm just bummed I didn't get it, you know?
Sure.
It's because you're creatively invested in it. Mm-hmm. And that's what it really comes down to for the pitch. And so I do feel like I in a room, I'm a pretty good communicator, and I'm a nerd. I'm a giant nerd. And so I've never had an issue expressing my passion for something. The main thing I notice is that it just really helps to show the executives on top of your passion that you've also done some homework. Mm-hmm. And so I've generally gone in with like an iPad. I have the iPad Pro, and you know, you can remote PowerPoint from your phone. Mm-hmm. And so I've gone in with like my iPad Pro and just set it up on the table, made a keynote presentation, and then synced it with my phone. And I'll just talk through all my exciting, like, this is what I'm excited about. There's my this, and just kind of structure a very nerdy conversation over some cool looking slides. Mm-hmm. And just kind of do that, like really just talk and support what I'm saying with a cool little flashy PowerPoint on an iPad that looks high tech. And then the best advice I ever got, and again, it's good advice. If this actually factored into any of my success, I actually have no idea. It just sounds nice. But they always say, like, don't always leave something behind in the room. Like, mm-hmm. always give them something to like remember you by. And so I normally make a PowerPoint that I could also print as a PDF. Mm. And so I'll make a PowerPoint that has all these flashy animations and it's just kind of nerdy and cool. But then they all form into kind of a cool splash page that I can print. And normally I'll have like a, you know, like an 8 to 10 page PDF document with some flashy looking pages. And I'll print copies for whoever's in the room and I'll leave those behind when I pack up my iPad to leave.
Interesting.
The thing with the iPad that's nice is you can whip it out pretty seamlessly. You know, I don't need to bring it out of a suitcase or a briefcase or anything. Like, I can literally have them under my arm, fold a cover, set it on the table and go.
Right.
So I don't know. That's kind of my vibe. And that's just kind of what I've been most comfortable with. I don't like showing sizzle reels. Mm-hmm. I actually don't even like cutting sizzle reels. They're like a necessary evil. I can't stand them.
Yeah.
So I normally save those for, I normally send those after the fact. Like, I normally like, hey, I cut a sizzle reel. I'd love to send that to you guys after the fact. And it gives me an excuse to follow up and thank them for the meeting. It gives me one more opportunity to lightly connect after I've left the room.
Right.
And I feel like it's easier for them to watch it on their own time and with headphones, if they even care.
Sure.
Then sit in a room and just awkwardly stand there while they watch like 2 minutes of the, or a minute and a half of this reel. Say, hey, so watch this and I'll stand over here. but I mean, some people do that, but that's just not my vibe. I can't do it.
Sure. So I'm curious, because I feel like this is connected to Pandora. I actually have no idea why. I have no evidence for this, but I assume it's connected because you worked on the Sci-Fi Channel movie, You Might Be the Killer, and Tom Vitale was the producer and writer on that. So I'm curious, like, how did that project come about? And you guys co-wrote the project together. So what was that process like?
Yeah. So first I should say that, you know, You Might Be the Killer, probably my favorite movie that I've made. Yeah. So like, whenever people want to see something I've done, the first one I offer is You Might Be the Killer, and then second is Husk. But You Might Be the Killer is the most like me movie. I just really love horror comedies. I really love genre bending, and I really love things that are, I love movies that are over the top and just shamelessly entertaining. It's Back to the Future is my favorite all the time.
I have to say too, it's a lot of fun. Like, it is very enjoyable movie to watch.
Thanks, man.
It's a big thumbs up, 5 stars for me. Like, so impressed.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that. And I'm very proud of it. And I feel like I can say that with sounding too braggy, because I didn't originate the script. It was a project that I was invited to be a part of, and then I was invited to be a bigger part of.
Oh.
Rings of Saturn.
Chalk.
Sam?
Don't think I'm really scared. Maybe you can help me out.
Being responsible for an entire summer camp.
Nature's our nature.
What could possibly go wrong?
Everything started out so great.
And now there's this crazed killer roaming the campground.
Wait, really?
Everyone is dead.
I mean, that sometimes happens.
Especially the camp counselors.
Like, is it an old camper back for blood?
How do you know that? How does knowing who it is help me not die?
Figuring out what they want could help you not die.
Smart.
Sam? you this, but are you sure you're not the killer?
Okay.
And so I mean, the short story of it is it was the same thing, like an executive that I knew from NBC Universal, who was now at Sci-Fi, had this project that was being pitched to them by Tom, and my name came up with him. And of course, Tom knew my name from the movies I had done for him. And Tom just seconded it. And so it was kind of like just two people were vouching to have me a part. So I was invited to join in as a director. There was no script yet. There was a treatment, and it was based off of a Twitter conversation, which,
oh boy,
I mean, looking back, the movie worked, thank God. But I mean, I can't believe that I didn't like balk it. It's a movie based off a Twitter conversation. I was on board.
Yep.
It's a very funny Twitter conversation. So it definitely is adaptable. Like I get it, but just kind of funny. That's where we are now. 2018, 2019, when we made the movie, making movies off Twitter combos. But, I was invited on as a director, but then what happened was, as the script came together, Tom had notes. He would ask me to give notes, and we noticed that we were both very much on the same page of what the movie needed to be. And the longer that it was coming together, we were very rushed. I should add that we were trying to go into production very quickly without a script. And so the original writer involved was very much under the gun.
Mm.
And so the note sessions were such that Tom and I realized how aligned we were, and it turned into, wow, like I'm now being invited to co-write this movie with Tom. And all of a sudden Tom and I started co-writing the movie together. And so then the movie became next level exciting because now my voice was in it.
Yeah.
And Tom was a dream to work with. Tom and I had so much fun writing the movie. Like it wasn't even fair to call it work because of how fun it was. We had a blast because Tom is also, he's also a big film nerd, and he's an encyclopedia of just horror movies, as am I. So we just had so much fun just kind of tapping into that side of ourselves, you know, and just doing something that was just kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It was really cool. We had a great time with that. So by the time we went into production, I mean, the movie was written in 3 weeks. It was prepped in 2 weeks. It was shot in 3 weeks. And then it was edited and finished in like 6 weeks. So, I mean, it's the fastest I've ever made a movie ever. But it's funny because I also feel like sometimes that pressure is the best thing that happens to you, because as an artist, you're constantly thinking about ideas. You're constantly ingesting content, and just eventually you have to learn to trust yourself that you can shoot from the hip because it's in your DNA. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be so calculated. And You Might Be the Killer is definitely an example of that, where there's a lot that was very calculated and there's a lot that was very much shooting from the hip. And I think the movie actually has benefited a lot from that. But that's how that came about. And what's really funny is Tom and I had such a great time writing together that we were instantly, like, even on set making the movie, like, man, we need to write something else. We need to do something else. And Tom was already down the river a little bit with Mark, just kind of putting together Pandora.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Altman, I'm talking about Mark as in Mark Altman, our showrunner.
Creator of
Pandora. Yep, exactly.
The reason why we
Tom was already, he's the father of the feast, or the founder of the feast. But Tom was already down the way with him a little bit on Pandora, kind of working with him. And so he had kind of whispered it to me on set, just like, hey, we got this show that trying to get going, and we get it going. I'd love to throw your name in the hat for directing some episodes. Maybe we can co-write an episode or two. Hmm. And, you know, I have found that when you find people that you like working with, you always want to try and find more opportunities to work together, but you have so little control about when those opportunities actually come.
Sure.
So of course I was like, heck yeah, Tom.
Yeah.
Call me and I'll be there. But in the back of my mind, I was like, I don't know if this will actually happen, but right. I hope it will. But so many things fall apart. You know, it's like, it's no one's fault. It's just the way that it is.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that I was pessimistic more than I was like, of course, like if it happens, yes, but let's see if it happens. And then next thing I know, it was like only months later after we premiered You Might Be the Killer, we premiered at Fantastic Fest.
Mm.
And then it's only like a couple months later that, Tom was like, hey, like it's happening. We sold the show. It's going to happen. We need to write some episodes.
Wow.
Like, let's make this real. And I was like, what? couldn't believe it. And then I was invited to the writer's room for Pandora, which is my first time in a writer's room, and met Mark, and just loved everybody that was there. And that whole process was crazy. But really, I just, after You Might Be the Killer, I kind of got slingshot straight into Pandora, which was really, really, really cool. And and part of it was because the whole impetus of my involvement was that one of the episodes Tom and I were going to be writing was going to be the quote unquote horror episode. And they wanted me to direct the horror episode, which is kind of my in. And meant that because I did that, I got to direct some just straight up sci-fi Star Trek stuff. And I am at the heart of it. I'm a big fan of Star Wars and Star Trek and Back to the Future before I'm a horror guy.
Amazing.
I just have been making a lot of horror, but it was great because I finally got to like scratch an itch that I haven't been given an opportunity to scratch just yet.
Absolutely.
And that brings us to Pandora. And then all of a sudden I'm in Pandora land.
It's great. You know, and absolutely, like let's transition to Pandora. But before we do, like, I want to ask a question that could cover both Pandora and You Might Be the Killer. Because I don't know why I feel this way, but I feel like we have a similar sensibilities when it comes to film and television, just from what we're talking about and things. And You Might Be the Killer has some big names in the genre, right? It's got Allison Hannigan in it. It's got some very recognizable faces. And, I presume you were a Buffy fan growing up, and I was,
of course,
a Buffy fan, and just madly in love with Willow to this day. And so I'm curious about, like, you know, whether you're working with these actors who you've been fans of for a long time. Keith David was another one. I mean, God, that was fun. Mm-hmm. But, or with Pandora, who are maybe, you know, people you're sometimes less familiar with, like, what's your approach to directing actors?
Oh man. Well,
I like to
well,
ask
first I should
questions.
Say that
I should
no, it's that. Good. It's good. No, I, you did your homework. You know, I got to go. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, right.
No,
it's, I have an actual life here. I have to leave.
No. Well, the reason I was hesitating is because it's, I was thinking back to some of the actors I've worked with, and it's funny because I've gotten to work with a few actors that I really look up to, and which was really intimidating to do. Like, I get really nervous about it. I mean, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of directors that play it cool, and I'm like, I don't know. I'm just not that guy. Mm-hmm. But I'm also really nerdy, and like, even going back, when I did Monkey's Paw, our main villain was played by Stephen Lang, and Stephen Lang was, the producers had worked with him before and really wanted to cast him. And Stephen Lang is a bucket list actor for me. Like, he's like since the beginning, he's been someone that I really wanted to work with. And I'm obsessed with Tombstone. It's just another one of my favorite movies.
Great movie.
And he and I were working together, and it was my first time working with an actor that I was starstruck by. And I'm trying to be cool, and I'm trying to be professional, and I feel like I'm succeeding mostly, but I'm also like, what business do I have working with Stephen Lang? I mean, he's worked with Michael Mann, and he's worked with all these guys, James Cameron. I'm like, what business does he have talking to good old Brett Simmons from San Diego? But then finally, I just like, after we had a rehearsal period for the movie, and I finally just was like, you know, Steve, and I, at the risk of losing any favor I've gained with you or any shred of dignity, I really need to talk to you about Tombstone. and to Stephen Lang's credit, he lit up. He was so excited to talk about it. And it turned into a rapport booster, as far as, you know, when we are working in between takes and in between, you know, days off, and just in the middle of conversations, just little stories about Tombstone slipping in, or questions and things, just dialogue about this movie that he loves. He's so proud of that movie and being a part of it, and has so many incredible stories. I'm pretty sure he said that, like, one day he's like, I got to write a book about this. And I'm like, I'm really hoping that he does. Cause man, he had some incredible stories to tell about a movie that I loved. And he's one of my favorite actors in the movie. So it's like, this was surreal. And that was crazy. But working with him was really, really intimidating because he's an incredible actor. And I just never felt like I was adequate to direct him, you know. Now it would be a different story, but at the time I was still like, I was much younger. Mm-hmm. And it happened on Pandora. The reason I bring it up is because it happened again on Pandora in episode 10 last season. Mm. Mark gave me the incredible gift of letting me work with Jeffrey Combs in episode 10. Mm. And Combs is another one of my bucket list actors. He's right there with Stephen Lang. Like, I am obsessed with the Frighteners.
Yes.
Yes, I like the Reanimator, of course. And I like Star Trek, of course. Like, I mean, all the things he's known for. Yes, I know him for that. But I'm obsessed with the Frighteners. And it was the same thing. I was so intimidated to meet him. Yeah. I just felt so unqualified to be his director. And I just broke the ice with him after we talked through the role and the story, the script, and all that stuff. I just like, man, you know, Jeff, I gotta ask you about Frighteners. And it just like, he lit up. He was like, I'm so proud of Frighteners. I would love to talk about Frighteners. And he and I had a great time talking. I mean, Jeff and I are still in touch. He did a lot of theater in San Diego at the Old Globe, and we had that in common. And he turned into, it's weird to say that he turned into a friend, but he did. Like, it was really surreal and the greatest thing ever. And like, I'm forever indebted to Mark and Pandora for giving me that. Cause that was like, a dream come true. But I'm like, that's a really long-winded setup to your question. You asked me about working with actors. Mm. And my big thing is this is, and I don't know how much of it comes from my theater background or how much of it comes from acting on set during college, but, actors really do have the hardest job on set. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's without question. I think that gets forgotten a lot. Mm-hmm. They really have the hardest job on set because everyone else gets to hide behind the camera. After the actors, I think the second hardest job on set is directing. Mm-hmm. Because the director gets blamed for everything.
Sure.
So even though it's just your name, it's not your face, you can still go to a coffee shop. You just might not get a job.
Right.
You know, if you screw it up. So those pressures are real. And those pressures are completely counter to being creative.
Mm-hmm.
And trusting your instincts. They really get you locked in your head. So in general, my approach to working with actors is just trying to create trust and trying to create comfort on set. And not everybody shares my opinion, but I'm very passionate about it. I take it very, very seriously, because all of my favorite takes I've ever gotten from actors have been when they were their most relaxed. When I'm doing movies, it's not, I've done it on the TV show, and we did a lot this season too, where I try and give them a play take, you know, at the end, once we've gotten it, try and give them a play take. When it's a movie that I've written, I'm much less loyal to what the words that I've written. Mm. And I normally let actors just straight up start improvising some of the scenes just to see what happens. Mm. Because even if it's not usable, I just find that it loosens up the atmosphere. It creates even more investment in the scene and even more comfort level with the scene. And it also just creates even more of a sense of teamwork between me and the cast just to accomplish the scene.
Right.
And all of that creates what we want the camera to capture, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my biggest thing. I mean, I have a lot of tactics for how I pull that off, but the overarching drive and mission is just to create an atmosphere of lifting the pressure so that they can give me their best.
From what I've heard too, like, we interviewed Nicole and Aksha earlier, were their roles as Zazie and Jed in upcoming season 2. And they just were talking about how relaxed and how enjoyable the set life was. Like, they just absolutely loved working on that. And it was so fantastic to hear that, because you definitely hear the stories too of, you know, like David Fincher making someone go through 150 takes or something to get certain.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, man, that sounds terrible. That's
Yeah, for sure.
So, you can tell when a show and when a movie where the people are just loving what they're doing, you know, we were talking briefly off camera about the recent news that Ben Affleck's coming back as Batman. And like, I think that part of the reason he's coming back is because he had a good time working on the role the first time he did it, you know, and like the first two times. And like, that sense that it creates a certain sense of love for the actors to the characters themselves. You know, it's more than just the job. It's a part of them. It's part of who they are, you know, and that's...
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the best thing that you can aspire to, I think, is to get that sort of connection, you know?
Yeah, and I think just because actors, their faces on camera, and because we see them all the time, I think we associate actors with just being really relaxed and being able to do it easily, because it's just what's so funny about our job is like the better all of us are at our job, the less work it looks like, you know? And that's what's so funny is like the best actors look like they're not having to work too hard, right? But that's the work that they're doing. They are working very hard to look like that, you know? And it's like the best production designers build a set that you don't notice, you know? Mm-hmm. The best wardrobe designers, costume designers are designing wardrobe you don't fully know. I mean, obviously you notice, but it fits into a world and
right. You
don't acknowledge it. You know, and actors are constantly needing to portray, you know, presence within a scene that's false because the scene isn't real. It's all fake. It's all on a set. It's all in front of a crew of 60 people, you know, the camera. Like, it's all fake, creating a sense that it's real. And so as a result, I think that it gets neglected a lot how hard it is. Mm-hmm. And even just like maybe their talent, maybe the performance of the scene is not hard. What's hard is tuning out the pressure of the set and the drama of the set. And, you know, we have the worst thing that happens for the cast, and I hate it when it does, but it's inevitable, is sometimes you have to shoot a scene way faster than you wanted to. And mm-hmm. sometimes you have to leave the scene before you feel like you nailed it because you just don't have time, you know? And man, that's sure another thing they don't teach in film school.
Right.
And, so you just have to do the best you can. And it's just like I was saying with You Might Be the Killer, you just kind of have to trust your DNA at that point. You just have to trust that your instincts and firing quick from the hip is going to work. And most of the time it does, you know. It's like, I think most of the time, 9 times out of 10, you know, we look back at what we were rushing through going, man, that felt horrible on the day. Like we were moving to it too fast through it. But looking back, it actually worked really well.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's hard. And especially with a younger cast, you know, I think the more experience you have, the less pressure, the less you let the pressure of the set get to you. But I mean, you know, again, going back to Stephen Lang and Jeffrey Combs, and, you know, I've worked with some experienced actors, and even all their experience, they overcome it, but they do still feel it. Sure. And they appreciate when they don't have to feel it. And they appreciate when a director is cultivating an environment that kind of shields them from that. Mm-hmm. And so especially when you're dealing with a younger cast, you know, we have an incredible cast on Pandora. But our cast is a younger cast, you know. It's like, it's just simply by age, you don't always have the years to know how to tune out that pressure. Right. And it's really important to me to tune that out for them as best I can. You know, mm-hmm. I can't 100%, but even if I can give them an extra 20% of relief, you know, that goes a long way for me and for
absolutely.
Them.
What would you say is that Brett Semmons element that you're able to inject into Pandora? You know, Pandora is this TV show. The rule of thumb is with TV shows is that every show kind of needs to look and feel the same as the others, you know? So, but you have such a distinctive voice as a director, and your episodes do stick out in a way that makes them distinctive from the others. And so I'm curious if you know consciously, like, what is that element that you're able to bring to the show?
Well, I'll give you an answer, but before I do, and this is because I'm blind to this, I'm not fishing for a compliment here. I literally am. I feel blind to this. What was it about my episodes that stood out to you? Like, as a viewer, like, what makes you like, oh yeah, that feels different. Like,
sure.
I'm asking because I'm trying to educate myself here. I have no idea. I feel like I don't know how special I am.
No problem. I'm all for fishing. I'm all for giving compliments. For me, I felt like with 104 and 105 specifically, we were able to get a bit more interiority from the characters than we had previously. It felt like there was a bit more character moments. Definitely 104, there was the emphasis on the horror elements a bit more. But I also felt, and I don't know if this was a conscious choice and a collaboration with Max or with the larger team. But it felt like those episodes, there started to become a bit more visual stylization going on in terms of color, in terms of lighting. And that is something that by the end of the season, it's very apparent how the color is used as a language for storytelling. But I felt that really started with your episodes. And
oh, interesting.
I could be totally off there, but I was...
No.
And definitely...
That's so cool.
Yeah, and like 110 to me is knocked it out of the park in so many ways. Like it was just, you know, such a pivotal moment for the characters in that season. And I was...
Oh, man.
That's really the best episode for me in season one.
Dude... Thank you. That means a lot to me. And I'm really proud of episode 10. I'm proud of everything I got to do, but 4 and 5 were hard because I'm block shooting both of them and they're both such different episodes. You feel schizophrenic.
Right.
You know, I kind of had PTSD doing it in season two, because I was block shooting 2 episodes again. They're both very different. And I'm proud to say that they're both coming together great, like I already said, but they, it does make you kind of schizophrenic, and I start feeling like it's like juggling kids where like one child's getting more attention than the other. Mm-hmm. Like the needier child is getting your attention, and then you don't realize how much you're neglecting the other one until it's too late. And
right.
it can feel like that. It can feel like that. And that was the one thing about 110 was it was so singular. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anything else to think about. And I do feel like that episode has some really cool, beats in it as a result of that. But I mean, I'm also really proud of 4 and 5. I mean,
sure.
It's funny. So, I mean, to answer your question, thank you for sharing that. That actually means a lot to me, because I never know what I'm doing that actually works or translates. I'm just, honestly, my whole style is I just want to do what I like and what I think is cool, to be honest. And I don't know if anyone agrees with me. I just hope that if I think it's cool, at least somebody does. I mean, I got a Millennium Falcon tattoo thinking, I think this is cool. And fortunately, when I go to the store, I meet a lot of people that also think it's cool. Yeah. But for all I know, I could be doing the dumbest thing ever by getting it, you know? So it's like the same thing with making movies, where all I know is what I like. I actually had, going back to earlier when I was talking about, you know, kind of the meetings I had with Husk, one of the meetings I had was with Wes Craven. I had met with Wes Craven before he passed away with his production company about doing a movie. And God, he was just one of the sweetest people ever. And I don't even think we talked about the movie more than we just like talked and just got to know each other. And that was, I mean, he had no business needing to get to know me, but I mean, I guess he did. He was interested in potentially having me work with him, but yeah. I was just happy to be meeting him. You know, I was just like freaking out and screaming inside. Good screaming, not screaming. One of the things he said was, he's just like, all he knows how to do. He's like, all I ever know how to do is do what scares me. And if it scares me, I'm just confident I'm not alone, you know. And he doesn't know how to, he's like, I don't think about what affects everybody. I just really singularly focus on what affects me and what works for me. And in general, that tends to work. And I'll never forget it. I've heard him say it in several other interviews since, but I remember when he said that to me, that was really, really informative. And it kind of relieves me of some pressure, because it's really easy to go like, kind of like clock the audience and the crowd. And I think it's really important as a filmmaker to be audience aware, but the audience should be yourself. It shouldn't be a room of 300 people. It should be yourself sitting in a theater. And Quentin Tarantino's kind of echoed similar thoughts about that, how he tries to make the stuff that he'd want to sit through and watch. You know, he is the audience that he's thinking about, you know. And I think that is pretty sound advice and seems to work. And that's definitely what I do. I mean, stylistically, kind of going back to the question, is I really love getting the camera up in people's faces.
Yes.
I really love character moments. And it's one of the things I'm obsessed with. They tease me on set because of how obsessed I am with some of the stuff Spielberg does. But the thing that Spielberg does in Zemeckis, I mean, Zemeckis is my hero, is that, it's almost like the frame is the only law that matters. Mm-hmm. And what is outside of the frame doesn't matter until it's in the frame, which I've noticed when you watch their movies, really afford them some theatrical license that not a lot of directors take, that most directors don't take, in the sense of reacting to something off camera for an obscene amount of time before you reveal it, which makes no sense on the day on the set. But when you're watching it through the frame and you're watching it on, you know, on a screen, it tells really palpable story and lets really palpable emotion hit because of what's coming into the frame and when and how it's coming into the frame, you know? And that's very much how I just operate in life just with filmmaking is I just really love just the law of the lens. I love people coming into frame. I love people turning into frame. I love people being up close in the frame and color is very intentional. So it's really funny that you call that out because color is, I used to draw a lot. I wanted to be a comic book artist before I wanted to be a filmmaker.
Oh, nice.
And just the power of color and angles and just again, frame, like what you're, the composition of the frame and blocking, it's also interesting. And that's another thing for me that I'm just really into blocking. I just love moving people around a room and moving a camera around people. Camera blocking, actor blocking is just my favorite thing ever. And in television, it really saves you time. If you could, you can be really smart about it and start to get, you know, five shots in one setup just by moving the camera here and having the actors reposition and do this. And if you go back and watch Spielberg's television stuff, it's like insane how much he does that and how well he does that without an edit.
Yeah.
And that's something in life that I've always been interested in, especially like coming from theater. Like they teach you blocking like crazy because in theater you only have one frame to work with. You have the proscenium or the stage, and that's literally it.
Yeah.
But you know they train you like crazy on how to make the position of your actors hit an emotional beat and create a picture.
Yes.
And it comes back to the same thing that really I'm super grateful that I was forced to learn because it's really informed my taste in movies and my taste in directors and just the creative decisions I make on set. So again, this is theory. I don't know how much I succeed at it or when, but it's definitely the target I'm always aiming at.
And well, I would
I'm glad to know that worked for somebody.
I would say it absolutely works. Like I thought it was so funny and it made so much sense when you said on Twitter before shooting how like it's your routine that you watch Spielberg's episode of Columbo, which
Murder by the Book.
I love that episode. And it was when I first watched it, I had no idea he had directed it at first, right? But I'm watching it, I'm like, This episode feels like someone, like whoever is directing this episode has a lot of talent. And then I see, oh, Spielberg directed it. Of course he did. But
yeah,
it's so interesting. And you know, for me, I'm a student of George Lucas. He's my hero in so many ways. And what I adore about the prequels in particular is that he uses the background and the color and the composition of the frame to tell the story visually in the same way that Hitchcock did.
Yeah.
And that takes an awareness of what the final product will be even before he has it, you know, like they're just there with the actors on the day. There's a green screen behind them, whatever, but it's that sort of meta awareness, that imagination to say like, but this is what it's going to be later, you know? And I think what you said earlier about your theater background, it makes so much sense because it's that same sort of idea. You know, theater is just, it's a lot of actors, but it's also a lot of the theater of the mind. And so you're using the sets to convey an emotion because you don't have the $200 million budget, you know? And in the way that like Pandora, you know, it's no secret. Everyone talks about it. We're not, you know, we don't have Game of Thrones level budgets, but what you guys are able to do with the sets, with the actors, it conveys things in such a powerful way.
Well, I think too, like I totally agree. And, you know, Chris Ledoux and I talked about this on set while he was there prepping with how it's, I just think creativity requires limitation. I think your most creative decisions come from problem solving. And I think you need it. And that's one of the things I love about TV show and TV and working on Pandora specifically was, you know, it's leaning into the limitations as opposed to complaining. You know, it's like, no, we have a real opportunity to do something really rad. And you wouldn't be trying to problem solve it if you had the world. You know, it's like, okay, this set is only this big. So how do we make this scene interesting within it? You know, and okay, so we only have this much time. So how do we tell this story in the least number of shots? And, you know, it's some of the coolest stuff I pulled off in Pandora was out of insane limitations. Because it squeezes ideas out of you. The pressure and limitation just presses presses the decisions out of you that might not otherwise have come out of you if they didn't, if the pressure didn't exist.
Yeah.
So I think of it a lot like, you know, it's a lot like the wine press, you know, like stomping on the grapes, where it's like, yeah, it's probably no fun for the grapes, but guess what it presses out is something very valuable, worth more than the grapes were.
That's fantastic. So I'm curious, you were over there shooting, you shot episodes one and two of season two, and they just completed filming, I think, last week. So where are you at currently with the process? You're back in the States. You know, what's your job
back in the
now?
States? So I'm back in the States. Mark is still in Bulgaria overseeing some production. And so he was very, very generous and let me go into the editing room kind of on our behalf to kind of oversee some of the edit. And, you know, it's really, that's the other thing about TV. It's kind of cool. It's different than film, but you know, like this isn't my show. This is Mark's show. And I feel very responsible in that regard for making sure Mark gets what he wants. But this season is so cool because, you know, I have a working relationship with Mark, and so Mark has, you know, I, to be honest, like just quick rabbit trail, I had such a good time being on set with Mark this season because Mark and I didn't get to, our paths kept crossing. We were like two ships passing the night last season. Every time I was there was when he was coming back to the States. And so I never actually got to be on set with Mark. And so I knew we got along and that we, you know, it was great working with him on the capacity that I was. But this season I actually got to be on set with him, and man, we had so much fun. We like nerd out about the same movies and same shots and when to do such. Like, it's just like, it feels like someone else like has your brain. And so you have like twice the energy and twice the drive and twice the ideas. And it was amazing. And so since he's still there and I'm here, you know, he's let me sit in on some of the edits, which in television isn't always the case. You know, it's like, it's kind of the director's job is to deliver the goods and then get out of the way. Which I'm comfortable with, you know, I just want to be supportive, but he's really asked me to step in and help with the edit a little bit. And so it's been really nice just overseeing the edit coming together on episodes one and two. And I'm feeling really good about them. They're looking awesome.
It's fantastic. Now talk to me a bit about, you know, what it was like to work during this quarantine period and how did that change your dynamic as a director, as the actors, you know, how did that all work?
Well, you know, the main thing, which is kind of goes back to what I mentioned earlier, is, man, the air on set was just unlike anything I've ever experienced, just as far as just the gratitude to be there. We all love making movies. We all love working in TV and film. And that opportunity has never been like robbed from us industry wide. You know, like we've all missed out on opportunities.
Right.
But the industry's never shut down on us on the level that it did these last few months.
Yeah.
Like on everybody, like universally, everybody. It's not like I lost out on a project and everyone's working without me. Like we've all been kind of out in the cold. Mm-hmm. And so to come back together for season two was just unbelievable. And I think that's what's going to be really cool about season two, is that season two of Pandora really has really inherited the enthusiasm of everyone just grateful to be back at work. I think season two has gotten better work out of everybody than it even already did in season one. Like everybody's not only comfortable coming back to a familiar set and familiar show and kind of getting back to a rhythm we know, but on top of all of that, which already makes for an even better season, on top of that, everyone's just so gung-ho to just work and be together and do their best, and stuff that I feel like people would have rolled their eyes at or just been like, oh, we really got to do that. Everyone's just like, who even cares? Let's do it. Let's just go. And so I think one thing that's really cool that season two really is inheriting that energy, which is cool. And I know that I definitely inherited it on set from my first two episodes. I didn't expect that. And I'm just so grateful. I'm like, dang, that was another gift that I wasn't accounting for, that was paying off every single day. It was really cool. And that's, you know, and that's the other thing with the pandemic was, you know, we were supposed to start season two before the pandemic hit, and the pandemic stalled us.
Yeah.
And, but one thing that was really cool about it was, knowing what we were going to be making, knowing the script, knowing, you know, where the season was going. And I think it just gave us all more time than we would have otherwise had to really stew and marinate on what we were going to do with it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's another benefit is, you know, you don't always get that. And it's a gift when it comes, you know, it's as opposed to just kind of sitting back like, oh man, why aren't we working? We should be working. You know, Mark was really motivating everybody to like, let's use this time. Let's make this productive time. Let's make this time that we can make work for us, you know? And yeah. I feel like we did. And
yeah, you know, I was thinking back to March. I mean, God, that was, you know, coming up on 6 months ago now, but like we were about ready to start shooting. You know, Mark was already over there. I imagine, were you even over there? I think you were probably over there too, you know?
No, just Max. It was just him, Max, and the cinematographer.
Right. Yes. But nevertheless, you know, there was a start date and it was coming up, and, you know, even though it would have been great then too, it's become such a better product because we've been able to, and I say we, I'm a very small part of this, but the team, Mark, yourself, you know, they were able to really craft a whole thing, a whole, you know, glorious meal about this season that, you know, was such a better product, such a benefit for having this extra time. And
yeah, so big time.
Definitely never been more excited about this season than I am right now.
Oh, I'm glad. It's going to be good. It's going to be good. I mean, I can only speak for the first two episodes right now, but I mean, I'm really jealous of episode 3 because man, like Chris Ledoux is just like pulling out all the stops. And like, I was watching the stuff that he was able to do on set and I'm like, oh my gosh, like I just, why can't I get to do all that stuff? It looks amazing. And then Bria Grant's there directing now and she's unbelievable. She's so talented. She's so good. And
so, she's had some just big films hit it on the festival circuit lately too.
She sure has. She's
rock star.
She's phenomenal. So I think that, you know, I always caution overhyping, but at the same time, like I think season 2 is going to be pretty exciting.
Same here. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. We've been talking for a while now, but, what do you got on the horizon? Like what's the things you're looking forward to?
Let's see. Well, you know, now that I'm back from Pandora, sorry, mm-hmm. I just had my daughter walk in on me.
That's okay.
right now, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing the show premiering in October for sure. Yeah. And then I got a couple scripts, one that is about to go out and then one that I'm just in the middle of writing that I hope to like start sending out beginning of next year. But, just a couple of original projects. Like I'm really just gearing up to get another movie going, you know? I don't know how much I should really talk about what they are, but
talk about everything.
Definitely way talk more. Well, you might be the killer was, yeah. Here's everything. Yes. And here's where you can download the PDF.
Let me break it down into a 3-act structure here for you.
So act one. So you start on it. No, it's been really wild because after You Might Be the Killer, it was just so gratifying getting to make a movie that felt so much like a Brett Simmons movie, that I've really just honed in on just dedicating all of my time to just doing that again. So yeah. I have two projects that are very much in the same, they very much will belong on a shelf with that movie, even though it'll be a little different. They definitely genre bend and they very much represent coming out of the head of Brett Simmons. And I'm really, really super, I don't know if I've been more excited about something that I've written. And so I'm getting ready to start going out with those. And the great thing is that they're pandemic friendly because everything you try to sell scripts now is about, you know, I don't know how much you've heard, but there's like the, what's pandemic friendly protocol as far as financing movies right now.
Exactly.
And so like there's all the check boxes, and so far they both check all those boxes. So my hopes are high. I'm not discouraged that that I'm going to be set back by the pandemic on getting the scripts out.
So what are you watching these days? Like what are you taking in? What's your passions?
Let's see. What am I watching? Gosh, you know, it's funny. After I watched Murder by the Book, which we mentioned that I watched before any time I shoot, I got on
it's
a
episode
big,
of Columbo for people who don't know.
Yeah, sorry. It's the second episode of season one of Columbo, and I
fantastic.
I became obsessed with just diving into more Columbo episodes. So I've actually been watching a ton of Columbo, which has kind of been hilarious.
That's great. I love it.
I've been watching a lot of that, and then I've been watching
what was I watching before that?
Oh, you know what? I watched Watchmen on HBO.
Oh, yeah, nice.
And that is, like, insane. It is bananas how great that show is.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Have you watched Host yet? The Shudder original that just came out?
No, I have not, but I need to.
I think you would appreciate it. I just watched it a couple of days ago, and I'm still just freaking out about it. It's amazing in every way, shape, and form.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, man.
I mean, I got to check it out. I've heard nothing but good things.
Oh, I think it's this decade's Paranormal Activity or something, like, or Blair Witch or whatever. Like,
wow.
It's that film that's going to be a major paradigm shift in a lot of ways. Like, it'll dictate a lot, I think, of what we see in the future.
Nice. Oh, that's so cool.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic.
I got to check it out. I love Shudder. I'm a big fan of Shudder.
Yeah. It's super short too. It's under an hour. Like it's
that's
like,
what I heard. I heard it's like not even like full length, but that's kind of cool. Like, but the streaming format it's interesting exploring different lengths of content.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's really rad.
Yeah. Well, the conceit of it is that it's the length, and it's not actually this, but it's meant to be the length of a free Zoom call. So it's
wow.
So it's that short. Yeah. And it's fantastic for that. I hope one day I can figure out, like, do they get sponsorship from Zoom? I don't know, but it's, but it is, it's utterly fantastic. I think you'd really dig it.
That's so cool. Yeah, I got to check that out. There's a lot I feel like I got to check out.
Oh, yeah. There's so much these days. So much Jesus. But anyway, so where can people find you on social media? Where can they connect with you?
Let's see. On Twitter, it's Brett_Simmons. That's Brett with two T's, which is really important. So that's Twitter. And then Instagram is really embarrassing, but it's Scarecrow Simmons. Scarecrow was my high school nickname.
Nice.
And, you know, I'm just stuck with it now. So don't judge me. Don't judge me. Brett Simmons wasn't available on Instagram.
It's cool. I'm fine. I'm into it.
Okay, cool. But yeah, that's where I am. Come on, say hi. I'll be sending updates about the show and stuff.
Fantastic. And for all the listeners out there, you can find us at Pandora Writers on Twitter and at Pandora Writers on Instagram, where you can see behind the scenes updates on season two, as well as occasionally me ranting about season one. If you like this show, please rate us 5 stars on iTunes and subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. And I hope you will join us again on future episodes of Unboxing Pandora. I want to say thank you to director Brett Simmons for joining us today. It was fantastic.
Hey, thanks for having me. I hope I wasn't too long-winded. I talked too much.
Please, I feel bad for taking up so much of your time. This was fantastic.
No.
I wanted to keep asking even more and more questions. I think we could talk for a very long time about things. But
agreed. Except about the Star Wars prequels.
No, only about the Star Wars prequels. Actually, that's what the entire episode should be about. It would be lovely.
I'm open to that. But it's gonna be an argument.
In a fun way, we'll have a fun debate about it. We'll down a 6-pack sometime. It'll be great. Anyway, back to the listeners. Listeners, thank you so much for listening. Hope you'll join us again soon. Brett, I will let you get back to your life. So thank you so much again for doing this. This was fantastic.
Of course, dude. Of course. I'm sure we'll be talking soon.
Absolutely.